Greetings and welcome back to another episode of Control Alt Army, stories from cyberspace where we talk with senior Army leaders about why cyber security and cyber operations type issues are commander's business, why they are leader's business in the Army and not something that we really just delegate to a help desk. My wonderful guest today is the Sergeant Major of the United States Army, Michael Weimer. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's an honor to be here. The Sergeant Major, I feel like it's the Ohio State University.
Exactly.
I attended that for a few years, so I don't know if you knew that, but that's good. I'm not going to call the help desk for this subject. There's ownership as a leader. I agree with you wholeheartedly, which is why I was excited to be able to come do this with you. Plus, I just love the alt control. That's a great name you came up with for this podcast. So excited to be here and absolutely believe in the vision and what you're trying to do.
Well, it's our honor to have you. Before we get to the questions and the substance of
sure.
the discussion, how are your first initial 6, 7, 8 months on the job going?
Yeah.
What do you like? What's the challenge? What's new?
Well, I mean, I guess, first off, I'm thoroughly enjoying the job. And that's no, small statement with how challenging it is to be a senior leader in the Pentagon with our current situations, whether it's, predictable funding or just global security, right? There's a lot of tough challenges we have right now. But I got to give SMA Grinston a shout out. I really do. His drive to have the selection process for his replacement early, which was done with a bunch of data, because he used SMAP, he used the CAP program. And so we went through a modified SMAP CCAP. And so it was a data-informed decision, which I thought you would appreciate. Yep, senior leader using data, imagine that. But it really helped the former chief, General McConville, make the decision to allow me and SMA Grinston to really build a transition plan. And so I've really been looking at what it means to be the Sergeant Major of the Army and what we have going on for the Army and the Joint Force since May. And if I didn't have that, I can't even imagine sitting here with you right now answering that question if day one would have been 1 August.
Got it.
And so again, I think, all that plays into, one, giving him the shout out, but the importance of information, having access to it, and then still having time to dedicate to be able to digest it, reflect upon it, right? Because AI wasn't going to do that for me.
Correct.
I still needed time to now dig into that and really have conversations and start to understand how this building works.
So a fascinating way to open that, in fact, leaders using data is a testament to just how you've even begun being.
That's why I had to start out with the, I don't think it's going to be that hard to weave a bunch of examples into our conversation today, because we're doing this. We've come a long way. We're living this now. We got room to grow, but we're getting better.
So one of the things we talk about a lot on the podcast is change over time and mm-hmm. how I think today you look at the Secretary of the Army's priorities, you look at basically anybody's priorities, mm-hmm. and they say data, they say the cyber, they say the AI, whatever. But earlier in your career, when you started, we generally begin these conversations with how did leaders and our Army think about technology when you came in? Why did you join initially? And tell us about that, those early years of service for you around this time.
When I was looking at this, one of your questions, I had to literally, in the spirit of answer the question, ATQ, as a good mentor of mine always reminds us, I had to write down, no, we did not think about technology when I started this journey. Mm. But then I had to reflect on it a little bit and go, that's not totally true. We thought about it in different ways. So I really appreciate where the chief's taken us with the mindset of continuous transformation, because I think it fits into exactly what you're asking about, right? So technology and modernization, it's the thing, but really it's a mindset. If you're content and happy with the status quo, then you don't even look at tech, since we're talking tech, maybe we're talking data, maybe we're talking, you know, AI. You don't even consider those things value added if you're content with the status quo. And so what I can say, in the early 90s, when I started this journey, we were never content with the status quo. We were always looking for an edge. Now we just talk about computing on the edge. So it's kind of changed a little bit. Like I wrote down, I remember modifying all my own kit. We never wore what we were issued. It was modified. That's innovative. That's, you know, we talk about innovation starts at the ground level, and great ideas start from the ground level. We were doing Shark Tanks before there was a Shark Tank. But we sewed pockets on our sleeves ourselves, 1993, and used to get in trouble for it. But when you were in the field, it was okay. We have pockets on our sleeves now in Garrison. And so, you know, the knee pads and the, so I think back, and you did a good job making me kind of think about this. We looked at it differently. It's just now, because we're so more advanced on the tech side, thanks to industry and government have equaled out a little bit. Government used to be where the majority of the tech innovation happened, but now it's not the case anymore. We struggle to keep up with industry, right? It's a good problem to have, but so that was kind of what I thought about for you. Was we've always been, and I've always been interested, because I can't handle the status quo. My team would tell you I'm always looking for the edge. I'm always looking to be better, faster, more efficient. And so that's really kind of the journey I've seen, and which is why I was interested today in November 2023 to come talk to you about this, because it went from sewing pockets on a shoulder to having one plugger, which is what we used to call the very first GPS I had on a team, that the giant antenna took to, it was a brick about this big, had giant batteries, and it only talked to military satellites. And we never used it because it was a pain in the rear end. Or the two sets of nods, night vision you had, and you tied those off with a piece of 550 cord string, and you put them in your pack because you never wanted to lose them because they didn't work really well. And now think about where we are today with things like IVAS and on the edge computing and, you know, cloud-based versus server stacks. And so it's evolved, but I think the mindset's very similar.
Do you feel like the service is doing a better job today than at that time in the 90s? You talked about usability and functionality. You know, my very limited time with the Army, I've been very impressed to see how much user feedback folks are trying to get before they really push a product out. Do you feel like today's Army takes into account that usability and that functionality for the soldiers?
I think we're getting better. I have the benefit of the special operations community, and so we've been on the on the front foot of a lot of the innovation stuff with some different authorities to play around with experimenting with new gear, new techniques, which I'm proud to say a lot of that eventually transitions over to the other services, the Army, big Army, and other services. That's a great model. To your point about experimenting early, learn, fail, learn. Ha, we got something. Now mass produce at larger scale. You know, the Silicon Valley model was kind of the soft model in the early years with things. But I would argue now we're at a crossroads, which is why the education piece is so important, is where we've got to actually up our game in understanding what we're talking about right now, because we're doing so much of that. I don't think we actually understand if we're capturing what we're learning at scale and sharing it, if we're relearning the same lessons in multiple places, which now is maybe not the best use of our resources. So I think we're at this new stage, which is why the push for education earlier, education for leaders so that we can make resource decisions is so critical right now. Because I mean, my daughters grew up with iPhones. And so my daughters had a better understanding of some of the stuff we're talking about when it comes to the cloud and, you know, cellular networks, the list goes on and on. My 19-year-old is giving my spouse and I a lesson on how things work, right? but we're the senior leader. So how did we shrink that gap so that the senior leaders were catching up with the newer generation that just grew up with it?
Got it. Well, speaking of education, which you brought up, I think another question that we've been discussing on the podcast mm-hmm. is as you've gone through different education experiences in the service, mm-hmm. different courses, different year-long opportunities to be in a learning environment, in addition to then being at Norwich as mm-hmm. well, did you feel like the opportunities to learn about the technological questions or issues you were most interested in, have those opportunities changed over time?
Absolutely. I give the younger generation a hard time. We used to coach, teach, mentor. Hey, there's no such thing as a silly question. Because back in the day, we didn't have access to everything at our fingertips. And so to not ask a question could be the one question everybody in the room has that leads to failure or success. Well, now, my girls, I have two girls, and I used to tell them, you got any questions? They're like, no, we just look it up ourselves, right? And so it's just it's a bit of a different mindset. So as a person that enjoys coaching and I enjoy developing leaders, I've had to like find that sweet spot over the years of like, how am I still value added when the generation below me coming up has access to all the information? It's just a very different mindset. Like we joke, and we're like, well, I had a set of Britannica encyclopedias. I still remember my parents bought that. And I'm an army brat, and we PCS'd and we moved around. And when I did homework, I busted out from the bookshelf. You know, nobody even knows what the Dewey Decimal System is anymore, right? We're in a very different place. And so now as leaders, how do we create environments to where you're having those discussions and you're still coaching, teaching, mentoring, and developing, and it's not ChatGPT doing it? And so we're in this space where I think we're trying to figure it out. But then now sometimes I go, you know, I'll look at one of my teammates and I'll go, what was that question you just asked me again? I'm pretty sure you know, were you on the Instagram all weekend, or was that something you could have researched, right? So I'm starting to notice a little bit of the opposite, which is sometimes it's just easier to ask somebody when I could have researched it myself. I joke, I would have loved to have been, I'm a very inquisitive person. I love asking questions. I love doing this because I walk away better. I do that with the internet. And sometimes I'm noticing now there's this lack of desire to research or actually debate and question and be skeptical when you actually have all the information at the palm of your hands.
So it sounds like, you know, that connectivity really offers leaders throughout the service new opportunities to mm-hmm. very quickly kind of work through.
Does.
You know, answers to questions on their mind and to work through things their yeah. staff is working through. You know, I guess one of the other questions was, what role is there for the yeah. Army educational establishment? And I think the essence of decision making for yeah. tough Army problems is not something you can just Google.
No.
So, I'd be curious yep. if you're seeing across the Army education enterprise courses or electives or seminars or yeah. late night study groups, anything yeah. like that tries to expose our up and coming next generation to, you've got all this technology at yeah. your hands. But as leaders in the service going forward, yeah. it's what to do with it, how to maximize yeah. an impact with it. Are those discussions happening, or you know, what can we do to promote those more?
So I think the discussions are happening. And I think we're in the phase of this discussion right now is how do we codify what right looks like? So there's the formal solutions. And then there's the informal solutions, right? So there's a responsibility of the unit I'm in to develop me as a leader and educate me. Then there's the responsibility of the, the every couple of years for TRADOC to provide a codified, time-based promotion, professional military education piece. And then there's the personal responsibility on the leader for self-development.
Sure.
I would argue my generation probably spent more time in this subject in the self-development. And the folks that really embraced this conversation It was self-development. It was studying, you know, coding. It was studying and researching and forcing conversations and setting up LPDs, leadership, you know, events to bring, you know, people in that you know, work cloud-based data collection and what it means for, you know, data garbage in is garbage out, and, you know, why the format matters. And if you weren't truly interested in that, I'm pretty sure what we would call SLC, ALC, and BLC wasn't going to teach you that. Those are our echelon sergeant, staff sergeant, sergeant first class professional military education programs. But the pivot that I've seen now is there's so much data. Actually, the chief of staff and I talk about this quite a bit. Chief staff of the Army, we're almost saturated with it. So, you know, when you talk data lakes and data, you know, I want access to every data pool there is, and then I want this one pane of glass, and then I want some algorithm in the back to spit it out and adjust the pane of glass to tell me this is the number one recommended course of action you should do. Well, that's a lot harder than it sounds, right? And we're in that space right now. So what I'm finding is people are a lot smarter than my generation was on what we want data to do for us. You know, data-centric collection, everything's a sensor, and then to make data-informed decisions. A company commander, first sergeant, battalion, they all want that. Now we're struggling on how do you do that?
Got it.
How do you do it at scale? How do you do it in a contested environment? And so I don't think there's an education issue on the value of it, the importance of it. Now we're just trying to figure out the mechanics behind it.
Got it. Okay, that's helpful. I was wondering if you could share with our audience perhaps a particular example of an assignment or two that you recall that comes to your mind when it first struck you in your career. Whoa, you know, I can't just lean on my six guys, you know, for understanding transport or what is going on with the network. Like, I need to take over some, you know, knowledge area for either technology or cybersecurity or even on power projection for cyber offense. Is there some set of experiences that really rings home for you?
Yeah, there really is. There was we've been afforded the opportunity for a long time to really be lazy in this space. That's what I call it. Lazy, again, because you have to be disciplined in cyberspace, or you're vulnerable to your adversaries, right? Because there is no more sanctuary. We're vulnerable in all these great things we have access to, the simplicity we talked about already, and they're all vulnerabilities because our adversaries, hopefully we always say near peer, we never eliminate the term near, but they're near enough that those are vectors and we're vulnerable. So I would tell you it goes all the way back probably about 2007 time frame. So that's a while ago, for me anyway. Maybe not for some of our viewers, but it's about 2007 where in the special operations community we spend a lot of time trying to do lower signature things, and the way we had been doing business all of a sudden was no longer acceptable on the risk scale because. People have started to really, in 2007, really started sharing databases. So everybody's been collecting data for a long time. We just talk about it a lot now, but it's actually been going on a long time. The Amazons, the Googles, and they realized quickly that there's money to be made in sharing, basically selling access to that data. And we realized that we couldn't hide in the white noise anymore with a lower signature for some of the things that we were asked to do in the special ops community, that we were vulnerable. Our data was in these data pools, in these databases. And they were selling them to other countries, and it's basically this global sharing, because again, the interconnectivity is like never before, right, across the globe, good and bad. And then that's when we had to like really take a look at our techniques and TTPs, as we would say in the Army, that we were doing to operate that really had just become status quo. Hey, we can get away with it. We're not vulnerable here. And that was, and oh, by the way, there are things that you, there were consequences, just to keep it simple in the unclass environment, there were consequences to these failures. And that is when I realized, that's why I can remember the time frame being about 2007 to 2009, we had to change how we perceived risk. Risk wasn't always something forward. It wasn't always when you were in the contact layer. Risk started well before, and oh, by the way, continued after, because we were so vulnerable in the digital space.
I see. So that's a powerful example, because you know, to my ear, that sounds like a discovery of risk to force and risk to mission.
100%.
That came from not being cognizant of the true implications of data, what is being collected, what was being collected, and the ability for others to package
it
and then disseminate it, whether for profit or for other malicious purposes. And that, that posed unacceptable risks to your
to today your we always go on the malicious side, the adversarial side, but really it's just global business practices now that are really where you're most vulnerable. Because it's just common to share access to all that stuff. Every time you click on something, every time you're like, collect these cookies, don't do this, I want 20% discount here, you're giving something away every time you do that. And the sum of all that giving away over time may cost you your identity, which identity theft's a big deal right now.
Sure.
The identity theft versus, you know, trying to steal national secrets, there's a fine line there, right? There, one is like criminal and the other is, you know, like espionage. But in the end, neither one of them are good. That's not something we had to worry about in the 1990s with simple how we communicate all day, every day.
So when the awareness of these risks really became clear to you, I'll tease the Army staff a little and just say, I assume your first move wasn't to convene a three-star GOSC, which feels to me sometimes is the universal staff answer is let's have a GOSC for anything and everything.
Yeah.
So how did you, just as a leader of women and men in uniform, start to think through not the actual technical solution or the fix, but just as a leader, how did you bring people together to say, we've got a problem and we've got to change course?
Yeah, it actually wasn't that difficult. It really just goes back to, again, what ChatGPT is never going to replace. We had to get leaders together, and we had to acknowledge, first we had to inform, and we had to acknowledge we found a new risk, probably been taking it longer than we know, because again, that had been happening longer than 2007 and 2009. We just became aware of it. So now we're exposed, we're assuming risk. You assume risk in everything you do, but now you gotta present that and you gotta talk about, is there a way to mitigate it or isn't there a way to mitigate it? And then do commanders still feel that we should assume that level of risk? And that's really what we do every day here. But that was 2007, 2009, but that's not new to leaders. It was just new because what we're talking about, squishy. Cybersecurity, squishy. When you talk about convoy security, or you talk about air escort security, or you talk about, you know, have overwatch for fires if anything happens, that's actually all the same verbiage in everything we use in cyber. It's just you can't see it, you can't touch it, you can't envision it. I would say now the journey of where we are November 23, leaders are starting to be able to envision it. It has a tangible, tactile feel to it now. That's a good thing. That's that educational journey that we kind of talked about already. I find way less devil's advocates at the table anymore when we start talking about cybersecurity and how vulnerable our network is and should we assume any more risk with the network. The chief is on fire about the network. For all the reasons we're talking about right now, because everything is hinged on a reliable, secure network that we can, you know, sometimes, you know, hide in plain sight and plain white noise, or completely disappear off the spectrum, right? And so we're in a good spot with this. I think the piece we're starting to realize now is the cost associated with truly mitigating the risk. So I'm actually half full in this space when it comes to leaders understanding the risk we're taking and the vulnerabilities that we have.
Let me ask you one other question just around that 2007 timeframe, if I could. How do you, you know, for our listeners who, again, maybe, you know, sort of coming up through the ranks, it's often the case, I think, that the you can see a problem, you can diagnose and say, whoa, we have risk to force, risk to mission. How do you balance then the need to reach out outside of a unit or outside of a particular and ask for help to better see yourself, to better bound the problem, and maybe have that honest ability to say, I don't know what the options are to mitigate risk, but before I go to my commanding officer, I need to phone some friends. So can I ask, just shed some light on how do you get help when you don't know yourself what to do?
Well, it usually starts with humility, because the step one is you have to admit you don't know. I'm smiling and laughing at that because that's actually a lot harder than we want to admit. But again, I was fortunate enough that when I was experiencing this this reality, it was for real operational things. And so what I've noticed over my journey is when the consequences are real, people are more apt to go, hey, we need to do some research here and reach out to other folks that specialize in this. We're above our pay grade. You've heard people say, I'm outside my IQ here. And I was in an organization that's very joint and very interagency. And so that wasn't actually that hard for us to do. But I do have to admit, if that would not have been, you know, real operational consequences, we probably would have been slower, just truth in lending. We would have been a little slower because it's, you know, roll your sleeves up, tighten your bootstraps, we'll figure this out. The space we're talking about here today, that doesn't work. This space, you have to be collaborative. There's what I call, you know, IQ in this space that you're never going to, no matter how much education, back to your other question, I am never going to be as well-versed in this as our cyber warriors. They are SMEs. And frankly, that's a good thing. So how we leverage them, how we leverage our NSA teammates on the interagency side, we're in a better space now. That doesn't mean that all that knowledge comes with resources, though.
Sure.
And then you're right back to risk. Am I willing to assume the risk that we now know we're taking? And those are tough decisions.
I think the hope is that over time, as you're describing, the cognizance, the awareness of the risk for parts of the Army beyond the technical, beyond the cyber, beyond the 17 series MOSs, beyond the G6s of the world, those resource decisions become more tangible. Yeah. And the trade-offs become more real.
Yeah.
Whereas when, as you described it so nicely, actually, when it's so squishy that you can't actually determine the risk, when you're not bought into the risk, the resourcing to mitigate it is really hard to make the case for. Just to mindful of your time, and thank you so much for spending part of your morning with us. Last thing I think it'd be great for the audience to hear from you about is when you're looking for talent, when you're trying to recruit, obviously looking for great leadership and all the usual Army characteristics, but are you looking for some awareness, some hunger about these issues? Tell us a little bit about what you're looking for.
So usually what I'll do in a talent management kind of frame of mind, I don't literally like talk to me about your data analytics background and how you see the value of, like, we used to do that. It used to be very direct. I'm not very direct with that. I'm trying to have a conversation with people. What I do is I usually start out with, you know, really trying to figure out if an individual that I'm either hiring or developing as a coach or a mentor, do they truly want to see themselves in whatever shop they're working, or just themselves as a leader. If you truly want to see yourself, and ignorance isn't bliss, then you're into data analytics. You have to be, because it's the only way you're going to be able to actually measure and get better. And so that's usually where I take the conversation. It's like, do you really want to see yourself, or you just talk about wanting to see yourself? To put it into very simple, you know, uniform military terms, I think it's the number one reason why people don't like fitness tests, because they don't actually want to know how fit they are or are not. They'll talk about it quite a bit, But then to actually go, okay, let me go actually see how fit I am. I think it's the same way with a lot of other decisions we make every day, all day long. If I don't balance my checkbook, I never have to worry about it. If I take money out of the ATM all the time, not that many people even know what that is anymore, but you and I do, do I want the thing to print me the balance, or do I just want another $100 out of there, right? So if a person isn't content with ignorance, and they really do want to see themselves, and they really do, I can't sit still, I'm always trying to look to be more efficient, then you're generally somebody that either is already into data analytics, because again, just collecting data is just, that's a step. Analyzing the data, which is why I love an ORSA. I love having somebody that does the analytics side of the house, and then does a really good job on now displaying what they found when they analyze the data. And then if you don't have that yet, but you're interested in that, then I'm usually very happy with checking that box off when I'm talking talent management. But when I have somebody that I'm talking or potentially talent managing in a more senior position, and they just, I don't see the value in it. I mean, what's worked for me has always worked good enough, you know, then I usually, to me, that's a bit of an indicator there's a blind spot there. Or it's not a blind spot. And now, because again, every position you increase in responsibility, there's institutional and organizational responsibility there. And we just don't. I mean, we work for the American people, and we don't have the luxury of being content with ignorance. We need to see ourselves. And so that's why this conversation is so important.
Got it. That's a powerful message. I mean, I really liked how you put it, that if you're really, truly into trying to see yourself, you are into data analytics, whether you know it or not.
Yes.
You are into it. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's a really nice point to go out on, because as we look at, I think, our services number one priority in terms of recruiting, the message to be able to tell the American people that actually, you know, you're coming into today's Army means that actually you are coming into a much more data savvy experience.
Absolutely.
And you will get that.
Absolutely.
If you come into today's Army, and that no Absolutely. Matter what you do
Yep.
with your career in the service, you're probably going to pick up some data analytics type experience. May not always be called that, but that fluency that you will build, whether again you're cognizant of it or not, I think is a great point.
I agree with you. It is starting to be woven right into the DNA of our culture, regardless of whether you're a vet tech, a cyber warrior, or you're on a tank crew. That tank, there's data being collected the entire time, whether it's for your maintenance or your round accuracy or your fuel consumption. I mean, it's happening all the time. So it's pretty safe to say you're going to join the United States Army. You're going to be part of this conversation. You're going to walk away, whether you serve 2 years, 4 years, or 20 years, data literate and understand the value of it.
I am pretty sure the recruiting command is going to want to quote you on that.
That's fine. That's great. Fine.
Thanks so much for joining
Absolutely.
Us today. Sergeant Major of the United States Army, what a treat to have you on the show. Thanks for sharing your stories of why cybersecurity, cyber operations, and just data literacy in general matter to the Army's leaders, and not just to a smaller, perhaps more insular technical community. For folks listening, we hope you've enjoyed the conversation. And our special thanks to our executive producer, Sergeant First Class L'Oreal McNeil, and additional creative director, Jasmine Monago. And we'll look forward to the next episode soon.
Awesome.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.